It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday is in front of us this hour. And joining us, Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Great to have you on, Wayne.
Hi, Ben.
Jim McCormick in our Ames studio, shuffling in from class quickly. Thank you. Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
I'm doing fine. And the task before you this hour that we have set out is to offer your analysis of the tests awaiting the next occupant of the White House. Not only that, but also to name the tests, sort of rank the tests, if I could ask you, Jim and Wayne, to do that. We also want to reach out to our listeners and ask you about the biggest foreign policy challenges you see facing the next president, and perhaps how you would characterize the differences in the candidates' world views now that we here in Iowa have been soaking up campaign rhetoric for a couple of years, the general election, a couple of months yet away. 1-866-780-9100. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Jim, may I start with you? What do you put at the top of the list of foreign policy, national security concerns for the next president?
Well, I think ISIS has to be put up on the top. I mean, that's the sort of ongoing, continuous issue that we've seen, but I, you know, all of these are lumped together and they all sort of feed off one another. In my list, I put in second place China, but you know, and then maybe Russia after that. But those would be ones that I immediately see. Those are largely non-state actor, interstate actor activities here that a new president is going to be confronted with.
Mm-hmm. I've heard analysis that ISIS, for instance, and I know the problem in Syria is greater than just ISIS, but we're focused on that and have been, that ISIS is really not an existential threat to the United States. Why then is it so high on your list?
Well, because it does have that non-state actor component, and it also has this problem of radicalizing some, even within the United States, or those that might come to the United States. So I think it is, in terms of an existential threat, that it would endanger the survival of the country. I think that's right. But I think in terms of the kind of tear and instability that it might produce in the short term, puts it, from my mind, something that has to be addressed.
Mm-hmm. In just a moment, Wayne, I want your views. But first, let's hear the candidates on this topic, terrorism, battling terrorism generally. This is a speech on terrorism this month. Donald Trump, a big comment here, softening his stance on NATO, which he had called obsolete.
We will also work very closely with NATO on this new mission. I had previously said that NATO was obsolete because it failed to deal adequately with terrorism. Since my comments, they have changed their policy and now have a new division focused on terror threats. Very good. Very, very good. I also believe that we could find common ground with Russia in the fight against ISIS. Wouldn't that be a good thing? Wouldn't that be a good thing?
Okay, from Donald Trump to his major party opponent in a speech in June, Hillary Clinton also called for strengthening ties with international partners.
We and our allies must work hand in hand to dismantle the networks that move money and propaganda and arms and fighters around the world. We have to stem the flow of jihadists from Europe and America to Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, and then back again. The only way to do this is by working closely with our partners, strengthening our alliances, not weakening them or walking away from them.
Okay. Wayne, to you about the challenges of terrorism, ISIS, Syria, all of that facing the next president.
Well, I agree with Jim that it's important to deal with ISIS. I think in the long run, I would regard the threats from China and Russia above the threat of ISIS. I put China at the top because they're all, this is a very complex issue. There are all sorts of things that conceivably could escalate in the future. Certainly the South China Sea, certainly the struggle over offshore islands with Japan, certainly China's effort to expand its influence in Southeast Asia. I think they're very important. Then on the Russian side, the thing that bothers me most there and why I would give it extremely high priority is there is Russian assertiveness in Eastern Europe and the possibility that it may even try military action against the Baltic states or certainly sponsor some kind of insurrections within the country. What worries me then is how would we respond to something like this? And then Russia and the United States have such large supplies of nuclear weapons, mm-hmm. stocks of nuclear weapons, that to me that's probably the less likely but most dangerous should the situation escalate.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, though, the United States to some degree cooperating in the fight against terrorism. Just yesterday, the Islamic State, this is rare, the Islamic State announcing that their senior strategist was killed in northern Syria. In Washington, the Pentagon spokesman, Peter Cook, confirmed a precision strike by American forces in Syria that they had targeted Mr. Adnani, this leader. However, we hear today Russia's Ministry of Defense on its official Facebook page saying that a Russian airstrike in Syria killed the ISIS spokesman. Russia's claim, according to a U.S. defense official, is a joke. So we have there both forces going against. I wonder, when we look at our presidential candidates, Jim, let me go to you for this. We just heard their voices on a certain facet of international cooperation in fighting terrorism. How would you characterize, how would you compare Donald Trump's and Hillary Clinton's approaches to meeting the threat posed by ISIS and terrorism in general?
Well, I think the major difference is just their view of how the international system should work. You heard from Hillary Clinton talking about reinforcing allies and working with allies. You know, several years ago, and I sort of, it sticks in my mind that she talks about that the United States must engage in a multi-partner world was the phraseology that she used to solve the global problem. She said that other states want to solve these problems and we should be willing to work with and be in a multi-partner world. I think Donald Trump, at least initially, although your quote, the quoted passage that you have suggests maybe a little bit softening of it, really wanted to be much more unilateral in this in terms of, you know, taking on ISIS, you know, and increasing the bombing and so on, although substantively both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have talked about increasing American airstrikes. I mean, the big difference is that Trump has not ruled out using American troops, and I think Hillary Clinton has made that quite clear that she would not use American troops in terms of dealing with ISIS. So mm-hmm. there's a substantive difference in terms of the unilateralism versus working with allies. Although both have called for, frankly, trying to get other states involved, a coalition of both Western states and Arab states to take on ISIS as well, sort of ramping up that piece of the puzzle.
Wayne Moyer, is that the way you see the differences between these candidates?
I certainly agree with Jim on the multilateralism versus unilateralism. Less with regard to the Middle East, but with regard to other areas of the world, I see more of a retrenchment in terms of U.S. commitments abroad from Trump than I do from Hillary Clinton. Trump has not been super supportive of NATO, has not been very supportive of the European Union, has called on reducing or eliminating our military forces in Korea and Japan, so sort of pulling back from some of U.S. commitments, while I think Hillary Clinton would keep the current commitments that the U.S. has.
What do we make of the Trump claim, and he repeated it and said it was a literal, he meant it literally, the claim that President Obama founded ISIS was in another setting the MVP of the Islamic terror group. I think Hillary Clinton, he named as co-founder of ISIS. When we talk about this sort of sophisticated foreign policy analysis, Jim, what are we to make of that kind of claim?
Well, I don't think that's supportable. Either of those claims are supportable. I mean, if he would have said, for example, that the withdrawal of American forces from Iraq, he could call it even prematurely in 2011, you know, that that contributed to the rise of ISIS and so on, you know, maybe he could make that case, you know, but this idea that they were the founders of ISIS seems a little bit off the chart to me.
Mm-hmm. But believed in many parts of the world, the Arab world, founding ISIS, giving the U.S. an excuse in this conspiracy theory, an excuse to put troops in Muslim states, Wayne. It's out there and it's believed by many people. That's why I raise it.
Yeah, but I agree with Jim. It's an extremely hard case to make. You already had very substantial instability in the Middle East, even before the U.S. went into Iraq originally. I think you could say maybe the U.S. invasion of Iraq had much more to do with it than anything that Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama did.
Mm-hmm. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College with us, as well as Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. Politics, an international version of our Politics Wednesday edition, looking at the foreign policy, national security challenges facing the next president. And perhaps you've seen that NPR, as part of the project A Nation Engaged, NPR and its member stations are exploring America's role in the world heading into this presidential election. So we're piggybacking on that a bit and also reaching out to you to talk about what you see as the biggest foreign policy challenges facing the next president. And also, how much does foreign policy weigh in your choice of a presidential candidate? Are you putting a lot of weight in that, in your choice of who to support in the general election? 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or write us an email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Well, let's talk about immigration. I think that must be somewhere on your lists as a foreign policy challenge. Donald Trump's surprise visit to Mexico today, hours before he's slated to make a major policy speech on immigration later today in Phoenix. This is seen as a bold move, meeting with Mexico's president, a person he has been very critical of in his rhetoric, likening that president, Mexican president, to Mussolini and Hitler. Let's go back, before we hear some of your analysis of immigration, this area of national security. One of the loudest applause lines at Mr. Trump's campaign rallies comes when he talks about, of course, building a wall along the U.S.-Mexican border, making Mexico pay for it. He talks about how he might be able to make that happen in this excerpt of an interview with CNN's Jake Tapper.
You talked about building a wall, having Mexico pay for it.
Yeah.
How exactly are you going to get Mexico to pay for it?
Look, Mexico has not treated us well. Mexico treats us as though we are stupid people, which, of course, our leaders are. I don't blame Mexico. China's even worse.
But how do you force a country to build a wall?
You force them because we give Mexico a fortune. Mexico makes a fortune because of us. A wall is a tiny little peanut compared to the kind of
money. So you would cut off business or impose tariffs unless they built the wall?
I would do something very severe unless they contributed or gave us the money to build the wall. I'd build it. I'd build it very nicely. I'm very good at building things.
Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto has said Mexico, no way, not paying for this wall. Here he is in his own interview with CNN.
There is no way that Mexico can pay a wall like that. But any decision can be taken for the government of the United States. Let me switch this to Spanish, because I think I'll be more precise than what I want to say. Lo importante es darle contexto a la relación y dejar muy en claro que...
What matters here is to place this relationship into context. We have to make it very clear that development and prosperity in the United States is built necessarily through the prosperity of its neighboring countries. We also have to bear in mind that the security of the United States is linked with the security of its neighboring countries. And this is what we have built. And I'll say it again, this is what we have been doing with the U.S. government. We have a relationship of coordination, of collaboration, and of cooperation in the area of security, precisely in order to have security in Mexico, to have security in the U.S. And we are journey companions, we are strategic partners working for security in North America.
Wayne Moyer, let me turn to you in light of today's events also, but stepping back from it to evaluate this, I guess national security was mentioned there. Our neighbor to the south tied up with the issue of domestic issue of immigration. Given the bad words and bad blood between these two men, can you imagine why Donald Trump would make such a move today?
Yes. I think he's trying to establish some kind of international credentials. He hasn't got much in the way of experience negotiating with foreign countries. And I think he wants to get the message across that he's a tough negotiator and he wants to renegotiate NAFTA. He wants to renegotiate with the Chinese. And I think he's hoping that this visit will create an impression with the public that he's a strong international negotiator and that will strengthen his support.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't he have to come back with something if he does? I mean, what if he comes back empty-handed?
Well, the meetings are private, so it's hard to know what he's likely to come out with. But my guess is what he'll say tonight in his speech is that I told the Mexican president what we have to do, so he won't announce results, but the fact, I think he's likely to emphasize simply that he's sort of put everything on the line and we won't know how the Mexicans responded.
Mm-hmm. Jim McCormick, how do you see the author of Art of the Deal going to Mexico, presumably for a deal?
Well, I think Wayne's right. We'll come back and make a statement tonight because, again, I think they must have agreed privately that they're not going to make public what their discussions were about. I mean, maybe that was one of the conditionalities of setting up this meeting. But I think that that Trump in his speech tonight will probably ballyhoo the fact that he was able to, first of all, get this meeting and, secondly, to convey to the Mexican leader what his position is. And it'll be interesting to see tonight. I mean, you know, over the past week, he's kind of vacillated on exactly who he's going to deport first and so on and so forth. So it'll be interesting to see if he says that I've clarified that and, you know, I've shared that with the Mexican president as well. So I think it might go in that direction as well as Wayne correctly says, to establish this international credential here, because he's really not met, at least in this kind of campaign setting, with many foreign leaders. And I don't know what his international experience has been sort of in business, although he claims he, you know, has had lots of experience that way.
Mm-hmm. How can this affect, you know, closely tied to our immigration debate, getting some kind of comprehensive immigration policy law passed through Congress, signed by the president? Can we say whether that's more likely under a President Trump or a Hillary Clinton?
Depends on the Congress, really. I mean, the composition of the Congress. I think that if there were a landslide on the Clinton side, for example, and they gain recontrol of the House and the Senate, at least if they got the Senate, they might be able to work a bill. With regard to Trump, of course, I think I think it would be more problematic, because even some of his own party would be reluctant to actually impose at least what he's articulated at this point, what he'd like to do on immigration.
Mm-hmm. I think it would take a landslide for the Democrats to really expect to get any kind of comprehensive immigration through.
Mm-hmm. It's more likely to be executive orders, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, that has become the pattern now, you know, with President Obama, and I think that will be there will be an imitation effect by the next president.
I was interested to see that NPR's Scott Horsley recently summed up the differences between the way the two major party candidates approach the world, their world views this way. Let's get your reaction. We have a couple minutes before we take a break. We'll come back and talk more in depth about China, North Korea, Russia, the Middle East. But this generalization by NPR's Scott Horsley, Republican Donald Trump sees the U.S. as the skinny kid on the beach getting sand kicked in his face. Democrat Hillary Clinton sees a world where the U.S. is still very much reigns as a superpower. Admittedly, a super simplified analysis there. But what about that picture, Wayne Moyer?
Well, I don't think it fits very well by any kind of measure in terms of international power, certainly in terms of U.S. military power. The U.S. is in a preeminent position, and there's very little evidence that the U.S. is getting pushed around internationally.
But that is the GOP line, that the U.S. is getting sand kicked in its face, and there's time for a change is needed, right?
Well, then the question becomes, well, what's the real evidence? There are some areas where the U.S. is not getting what it wants, but if you look at overall what U.S. foreign policy objectives are, overall what U.S. influence is in terms of international trade, clearly the U.S. is still in a very strong position.
Mm-hmm. We have about a minute before we go to break. Jim McCormick, how do you see it there in that simplified getting sand kicked in the face type?
Well, I don't think we're that skinny little kid. I think Wayne's right. We're fairly robust, but I think Trump, what he'd like to do is even grow that robustness even more as a way to get increased kind of deference from the international community. I mean, if you look at what he says about the military and so on. So I think he's not happy with really the size of American influence, even at this juncture.
Okay, we're going to go away for a few minutes, a very short break, and then come back with Jim McCormick of Iowa State University and Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, our political analysts for this Politics Wednesday, as we consider politics abroad and how they affect domestic politics. Also asking what are likely to be the major foreign policy / national security challenges to face the next president. Perhaps you'd like to weigh in on this. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org is our email. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. We'll talk about China's relations with the United States, strained lately. Those tensions in the South China Sea, we'll ask about those. Also, North Korea, Russia, the Middle East, plenty to come on this international politics edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a few minutes. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, international politics on this Politics Wednesday edition. Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. We hope you'll join our conversation as we discuss the foreign policy tests awaiting the next occupant of the White House. 1-866-780-9100. Wayne, Jim, a while in the first half, we talked about immigration extensively. Kyle is on the line from Dubuque. Kyle, welcome to the program. And how do you see the candidates' differences on immigration?
Thanks. I think we've been going backwards a long time. Right now we've got President Obama bragging about bringing over 10,000 Syrian refugees. We can't even take care of our own poor or our military. There's ridiculous that we're bringing in. We need to be getting rid of all the illegal immigrants. I think in between Obama and Clinton, they've destabilized the world as a whole. I think they start more fires than they even come close to putting out. I think their idea of giving everything away is not going to work economically. I mean, you can't give stuff away. I think
What do you mean give away there, Kyle? Just to
as far as when you got welfare, health care,
okay,
free cell phones for people who don't want to work. They said health care wasn't going to cost us anything.
We're getting into domestic politics. Okay. We're focusing on foreign policy today. So for immigration, it sounds like you may
let's
be backing. For immigration, it sounds like you may be backing Donald Trump.
absolutely. And if you want to go as far as economics, they want to give everybody to every country. They think handing money to countries that hate us is going to solve problems. To Iran, Iraq, Syria, we're just going to hand them money, money, money. They hate us anyways.
Okay.
Let them hate us, and we'll keep our trillions of dollars.
Okay, Kyle from Dubuque, Iowa. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Wayne, would you like to comment on Kyle's position there?
Well, the only thing, I guess a couple things I would say is, one, most probably the immigrants in this country are legal immigrants, and they are making very, very substantial contributions to the economy of this country. And that is also true for many illegal immigrants who, in fact, are paying Social Security taxes and are not getting any benefits from them. So I think it's not – it's a very complex issue. I don't think it can be simplified simply by saying that illegal immigrants are not making contributions to this country.
Okay, let's move on to some other ones on the list. We talked about China, North Korea, but also Russia. Jim, tell us, how has the U.S. viewed Russia in recent years under Vladimir Putin?
Well, under Vladimir Putin, of course, we have taken a much more skeptical view in light of Putin's actions. Maybe skeptical is too weak a term to even use. A very jaundiced view of what Putin's intentions are with his actions with regard to Ukraine and in Crimea, and just sort of his boisterous kind of actions that he's really thinks that the displacement of the Soviet Union was one of the great tragedies of history here. So I think that the United States has now viewing Russia much more skeptically, reinforced actions with regard to NATO. For example, we now have some military flight training and in the Baltic areas as well. And we're also going to upgrade in terms of defense systems within NATO here. And I think our NATO partners have also ramped up some of their actions here.
Concerning this election campaign and Russia, questions have been raised about Donald Trump's business connections in Russia, his relationship with Vladimir Putin, whether he's softening the current U.S. stance against Russia's actions in Ukraine. Here he is, a bit of him in an interview with ABC. Here's what he told George Stephanopoulos.
He's not going into Ukraine, okay, just so you understand. He's not going to go into Ukraine. All right, you can mark it down, you can put it down, you can take it anywhere
you want. Well,
he's
already there, isn't he?
Okay. Well, he's there in a certain way, but I'm not there. You have Obama there. And frankly, that whole part of the world is a mess under Obama. With all the strength that you're talking about and all of the power of NATO and all of this, in the meantime, he's going away. He takes Crimea. He's sort of, I mean...
But you said you might recognize that.
I'm going to take a look at it. But, you know, the people of Crimea, from what I've heard, would rather be with Russia than where they were. And you have to look at that also. Now, that was under, just so you understand, that was done under Obama's administration. And as far as Ukraine is concerned, it's a mess. And that's under the Obama's administration with his strong ties to NATO. So with all of these strong ties to NATO, Ukraine is a mess. Crimea has been taken. Don't blame Donald Trump for that.
You've said
we'll do better, and yet we'll have a better relationship with Russia. And having a good relationship, maybe, and having a good relationship with Russia is a good thing, not a bad thing.
Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, on the other hand, has previously called Vladimir Putin a tough guy with a thin skin whose political view is of a stronger Russia. Here's what she said about Ukraine in a speech at UCLA in 2014.
I support the administration's call for Russia to respect its obligations and to refrain from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of Ukraine. In fact, all parties should avoid steps that could be misinterpreted or lead to miscalculation at this delicate time.
Okay, given these and other comments by the major party candidates, Wayne, how do you size up this challenge and how the candidates would meet it differently?
I think the basic question is, okay, what are Russia's goals really with regard to Europe? And what I see is that Putin is doing all that he can to strengthen Russian influence in Europe. And part of that is weakening NATO. Part of it is weakening the influence of the European, or the unity of the European Union. Part of it is limiting American, U.S. influence in Europe. And so I think rather than looking at just any one region, as Trump was doing, just focusing on Crimea, that one should look at Putin in terms of his overall strategy, which I think is a continuation of historic Russian strategy in one sense, and that we have to deal with the big picture as well as the specifics.
Let's go to George, one of our listeners calling from Sherdan, Iowa. George, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Yes. Well, first I'd like to say that the Donald and Hillary, neither one are fit to be president, and much of the debate that goes on between them is totally ridiculous. That the foreign policy concerns that they expressed and the ones that I've heard on this program today missed the point, and that many of the policy concerns that you're concerned about are the result of many of the recent administrations following the neocon policy of regime change. So it's whether it's Iraq, Libya, Syria, or the Ukraine, we are meddling in other sovereign countries' affairs when we have no right to.
Okay, so you'd like the United States to be less of a part of goings on in the rest of the world, certainly militarily. So what choices do you? Yeah, go ahead, George. Where is your support going in November?
I do not say that at all. We should be involved in all kinds of countries, be related to them. Our economies are totally interdependent. Look at China. You talk about China being a big threat. Well, my gosh, just about everything you buy in the United States comes from China. Can you imagine there being a dispute that would disrupt trade with China? Why, our economy would collapse. So it's ridiculous to talk about China or Russia as being a threat to anywhere. We
okay.
were the ones that surrounded Russia with NATO,
okay.
which was against the agreements that we had with Russia.
Okay, George, thank you very much. Let's talk a little bit about this, a point that George makes there, Russia, China. Jim, sort of, I guess, can we use the word frenemy?
Well, certainly, Donald Trump has talked about having a friendlier relationship with Russia. I guess I'm a little bit concerned about this idea that we shouldn't be meddling. I agree we shouldn't be meddling in other countries, but I'm equally concerned about Russia, as Wayne pointed out, not only trying to sort of break the back of NATO and with their policy in Crimea, Ukraine, but also trying to break the transatlantic connection in terms of the stability of the international system. So I think we do have some legitimate interests that of what happens in these countries. It's not that we're going to go impose, but we should certainly try to stand up for our interests here and, you know, certainly serve as a sort of a backstop to what Russia is trying to accomplish in some of these areas.
Mm-hmm. Relations between the U.S. and China strained lately. We've talked about this several times on this program, in large part because of the tensions in the South China Sea. Half of the world's trade passes through the South China Sea. So how do we counter that or work with China, I guess is a more positive way to put it, Wayne, when we talk about those tensions in the South China Sea? Do you see that tensions rising, or do you see some way of cooperation there?
Well, I think it's a complex, both cooperation and complex relationship. Clearly, certain aspects, South China Sea being one, is an element of conflict between the U.S. and China. Certainly, trade relations and mutual benefits to both sides are an element of cooperation. And I think what our goal in foreign policy ought to be to do what we can to emphasize the benefits for both sides of cooperative relationships. And there are all sorts of things, trades where we can cooperate. Trade is one, climate change is another, and try to minimize the impact of the conflicting elements of the relationship and emphasize the benefits for both sides of the of working together cooperatively where we can. On the other hand, not backing down in terms of areas where we have conflict, but holding the position and protecting our interests.
Have either of you seen the chief differences regarding China between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton?
Yeah, I have. Trump is essentially not working to cooperate with China. He's trying to challenge China. Interesting difference from his policy toward Russia, that they've rigged their currency, the trade relationship with the United States. They have to make very substantial concessions. He's putting more military forces in the South China Sea. So I don't see the element of cooperation with China there.
Jim, anything to add?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, Trump does want to increase the U.S. presence in the South China Sea. But I guess I would just emphasize a little bit that these kind of reclamation projects that the Chinese are undertaking here and threatening freedom of navigation and their rejection of what the World Court or International Court of Justice has said with regard to the Philippine claims here, I think cannot go unanswered. So I think maybe I will differ a little bit. I think that we need some presence there because also in terms of in terms of providing security, and the United States has always been really an important participant in providing security within South China area, as well as East China, East Asia area as well. I think we do have to have some military presence there, but there clearly is a difference in terms of the focus on cooperation and the focus on more of a conflict kind of prone. I think we ought to talk a little bit about the TPP, which both candidates have opposed,
the trade agreement proposed with Asia.
That's right, which I find really remarkable in terms of dealing with the whole question of China and in terms of any kind of pivot that the United States has taken towards Asia, really does involve that. I'm frankly very puzzled by Clinton's decision to oppose the TPP after she was such a real proponent of the pivot as well as the TPP earlier on. I mean, my explanation is that it's largely electoral politics in the short term. And Trump has just declared it a terrible deal, and I don't think he's been any more specific than that. But I think that's a very important component of our efforts to, let me use the word, to hedge against the expansion of Chinese influence in that area of the world.
Yeah, I would strongly agree with what Jim is saying on that. And I am really sorry that the content of the TPP has not been discussed very much at all. And it's become kind of a symbolic TPP versus non-TPP. And there are some things in the TPP that will clearly benefit the United States, not only politically, but also economically, will benefit Iowa economically.
Yeah, and I think the political component of the TPP has not been emphasized enough. I mean, you can haggle a little bit about the economic benefits, who's going to gain in the short term, and are multinational corporations going to get too much power and influence, which is a principal complaint, as well as labor rights and all of that. But the political benefits for the United States in terms of embracing Southeast Asia, for example, and the Southeast Asian nations, which are all heavily dependent at the present time on Chinese trade, I think are, in the short term, incalculable and should be a major, major reason for the United States to embrace the TPP.
Final 5 minutes with Jim McCormick and Wayne Moyer on this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River, looking abroad to see how it connects with our domestic politics and looking at the challenges in terms of foreign policy facing the next occupant of the White House, Tom, in Iowa City. Tom, welcome to the program. Not much time. What did you want to bring to the fore?
I have degrees and personal experience in Central America and Mexico. My degrees are with honors and with distinction.
Tom, we don't have much time, but we need to cut to the chase and get to your question, please.
Not a question, it's a comment.
Okay.
Which is, first of all, there's never been a terrorist enter the United States from Mexico. Second, Ulysses Grant, who was certainly not known for being a pushover, described the Mexican-American War in the 1840s as the most wicked war we ever fought, which is what it would take to require Mexico to build a wall. We just have to take the place over.
Okay.
Thirdly, people don't like to just pick up and leave their families and their homes and so forth. And they do so because they're desperate. Not in Guatemala, for example, in the 1970s when I
Tom, I'm afraid we're running short of time, Tom, to go back that far in history. We're going to wind up here, Jim and Wayne here. We haven't talked about North Korea. Perhaps we've talked about it many times on previous programs, the secretive state in the Korean Peninsula. Today, news that North Korea executed its vice premier for education, rebuked to two high-ranking officials. Bring us up to speed on what the challenges are. They the same as in the past. Jim McCormick, when we look at North Korea, I don't know if the Western powers have handled North Korea very well in the past years. Do you feel so?
Well, I agree. I mean, the real challenge there, of course, is really talking about nuclear proliferation, and that has been for the Obama administration, you know, sort of their issue number one, or maybe issue number 1A with climate change. And that really no real progress has been made in terms of dealing anything with the kind of proliferation issue. We've actually had three more nuclear tests over the last 8 years here, or 7.5 years. So North Korea remains a challenge. And, you know, just looking at what the candidates have said about North Korea, they want to put on more sanctions and, you know, maybe get China to do more. But we've tried that, and it's going to be one of those unsettling kind of issues, I think, for any future president.
Right, and Wayne Moyer, your comment also that we have North Korea now with nuclear weapons, also testing just a few days ago a submarine-based ballistic missile.
Yeah, and the thing that worries me most is it looks now like they are developing a warhead for a missile that would carry nuclear weapons and conceivably eventually carry them at least as far as the continental United States, and I think that's a very serious concern.
That won't be allowed to happen, will it, Wayne?
Well, the question is, how do you stop them from developing the warhead? Are we willing to use military force? Now, there is an issue of building anti-ballistic missile systems in Japan and in South Korea. But it's not clear what kind of leverage that we can have to get North Korea to give up its program, its nuclear program, at this stage of the game. China is willing to help us, but not only to a certain point. And China's afraid of destabilizing the regime and then the population outflow from North Korea that would be likely follow that. So I think our best bet in the short term is strong deterrence in hopes that North Korea will see that and will be deterred.
Mm-hmm.
And that issue might rise to number one on our list, going back to Ben, while you started this program.
Yes.
Because, you know, with this continued escalation by the regime in North Korea, that that may be the immediate challenge for a new president. We'll have to wait and see.
Mm-hmm. Do you see there, Jim, very quickly, your view on the differences? Hillary Clinton more or less along Obama's lines here, approaching, facing North Korea's challenge?
Well, they're both want to increase the kind of sanctions here. I guess the troubling comments by Donald Trump is that what he said about the alliance structure with South Korea and Japan. I mean, this is no time to sort of back off those alliance structures.
And that what the comment that perhaps Japan should be allowed to get its own nuclear weapons.
That's right. Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, that's, you know, and to force them to pay more for their defense. I think in the short term that probably is not going to be, you know, very workable in terms of the threat that North Korea faces.
We have to go.
And also withdrawing troops from Korea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wayne and Jim, we have to go. Sorry to say. Rosenfield, professor of political science at Grinnell College. Wayne Moyer, Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Jim and Wayne, always a pleasure to have your analysis and your insights. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow, writers from the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa, along with its director, Chris Merrill. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.